All right, we are finished with Acts chapter 1, looking at Acts chapter 2, and not going to be here next Sunday, so that's the reason that we're going to go ahead and deal with some of the material that's introductory today. I do want to show you why, in some ways, Acts chapter 2 is so important. We have, over the last year, engaged in some studies which show that there were several things in the Old Testament that pointed forward somehow to the New. And when you look at what happened with the Hebrew people, they left Egypt, and it doesn't take them too long to get over to Mount Sinai. What happened at Sinai was really important. But also it's the case that what happened at Sinai pointed forward to the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2. If you've never looked at some of the parallels between what happened at Sinai and what happened in Acts chapter 2, there are several that are really surprising. I've never tried to lay this out on the board before, but we'll try to do that today and make the points. It will be helpful perhaps to have two readers lined up. Somebody for the book of Exodus. We'll flip you around a little bit, but you'll pretty much be in Exodus 19, Exodus chapter 20 for most of the reading, and then have somebody over in Acts chapter 2, and then we'll get a couple of extra helpers for some passages outside these two areas. Anybody want to go back to Exodus? Okay, Betty, Exodus 19, Exodus 20. We'll start out with Exodus chapter 24. We'll move ahead a little bit and then go back to Exodus 19. But Exodus 24, 13, that'll be first. And then somebody want to take care of Acts chapter 2. All right. Dolores, let's take you. And Jeff, if you'll be one of my outside readers, we'll head you over to the book of Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 2, verse 3. Dolores, when we're ready for you, it'll be Acts chapter 2, verse 1. All right, let's go back to the Old Testament. We'll put our references up here. Put the book of Exodus. Put the book of Acts. And we may have some extra references, so you may have, for example, over here in Exodus, also an Isaiah reference, but for the most part, they'll come from Acts and Exodus. And let's see what we find in Exodus chapter 24, verse 13.
And Moses rose up, and his minister Joshua, and Moses went up into the mountain of God.
Okay. We read about the mountain of God. And we do remember that when the Hebrew people went to Sinai, you know, Moses was on the mountain, and there was a time when the people decided to play. They became involved with sin. Moses goes on the mountain to get the Ten Commandments and so forth. So mountain is definitely involved with that Old Testament period. All right, then we look forward a little bit. This is where we go to Jeff. And again, like with Exodus, we have Acts here, but we will have a couple of supplemental references too. And we're going to put one in here. This would be Isaiah chapter 2, verse 3.
And many people shall go and say, come ye, and let us go to, up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem.
Okay. This is an Old Testament reference, but it does point forward to the New Testament. So, with the Hebrew people, Mount Sinai. And God, as he talks about the New Testament, he says the New Testament's also going to be associated with the mountain. Not a literal mountain, but it's going to be Mount what? Not Sinai, this time it's going to be Mount Zion. So if this was all we had, a reference to a mountain and a reference to a mountain, we might not think that there's that much involved. But then we start looking at some other things. When we think about the people of God, they've been in Egyptian bondage for more than 400 years. God redeems them, he brings them out. And when we look at Pentecost, what do we find? Redeemed or unredeemed people. We sing about it. Redeemed by the blood of the Lamb. So when we think about the New Testament, we're also dealing with redemption. Back to some Bible parallels. Here's another one. Anybody know offhand? After the Hebrew people get out of Egypt, how many days transpire, how many days go by before you have Moses getting the Ten Commandments? 50. When you look at what happens with Jesus as far as the New Testament, from his death up until the time that the New Testament is instituted, you want to take a guess at how many days we're looking at? 50. You can go back and put that all together as far as the timing. I'm not going to do that in class. Exodus chapter 19, verse 16.
Exodus
19? Uh-huh, verse 16. And then we'll head over to our next reference is going to be Acts chapter 2, verse 15. But Exodus chapter 19, verse 16.
And it came to pass on the third day in the morning that there were thunders and lightning and a thick cloud on the mount, and the voice of the trumpet exceeding loud, so that all the people that were in the camp trembled.
Okay, here again, we go back to Sinai, and when you look at the time, the general time of day, what time was it? Morning?
Morning.
All right. Let's take a look at what we have over here in the book of Acts, chapter 2, verse 1.
1 or 15?
I mixed some things up here. It should be 2:15, and then Betty, we're going to run you back. Okay. Would you read verse 16, Betty?
Verse 16.
Is that what I had you read, or what?
You had me read verse 16 of chapter.
Okay, that should be right. I got off of my notes here. Then you're right, Dolores. Acts 2, verse 15.
These people are not drunk as you suppose. It's only 9 in the morning.
Okay, that translation makes it a lot clearer. Some translations will say the third hour of the day, which would have been 9 a.m. So again, when you go back and you look at the Old Testament, you've got a mountain, you've got the redeemed people, 50 days, morning. Now you're dealing with 9 a.m., which we would also say. All right, back in Exodus chapter 19, Betty, let's look at Exodus chapter 19, verse 1. I should have had this one first.
Verse 1?
Yeah, 19:1.
In the third month, when the children of Israel were gone forth out of the land of Egypt, the same day came they into the wilderness of Sinai.
Okay. You have there, would you read that once more? I was looking for the expression in the camp or something close to it.
In the third month, when the children of Israel were gone forth out of the land of Egypt, the same day came they into the wilderness of Sinai. Verse 2 says, for they were departed from Rephidim and were come to the desert of Sinai and pitched in the wilderness. And there Israel camped before the mount.
Okay. Second verse helps clarify it. So, thank you. They're in the camp. And then let's go back, Dolores, to Acts chapter 2, verse 1.
When the day of Pentecost came, they were all together in one place.
Yeah. So, morning, in the camp, Acts 2, verse 1, all together. The parallels continue. Let's take a look, Betty, if you go forward a chapter to Exodus chapter 20, verse 22. And then Dolores will go back to you and look at Acts chapter 2, verse 2. Exodus 20, verse 22.
And the Lord said unto Moses, thus thou shalt say unto the children of Israel, you have seen that I have talked with you from heaven.
Okay, from heaven. There's divine communication. Now let's take a look at Acts chapter 2, verse 2.
Suddenly a sound like the blowing of a violent wind came from heaven and filled the whole house where they were sitting.
Okay, very interesting that you have the same language being applied to both. All right, back to Exodus chapter 19, look at 16 through 19. Exodus 16 through 19.
Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor.
Is that chapter 20 or is that 19?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, that's okay.
19, 16 through 19.
Uh-huh.
And it came to pass on the third day of the morning, there were thunder and lightnings and a thick cloud upon the mount, and the voice of the trumpet exceeding loud, so that all the people that was in the camp trembled. And Moses brought forth the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the neither part of the mount. And Mount Sinai was altogether on a smoke of the Lord descending upon it in fire, and the smoke thereof descended as the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mount quaked greatly.
All right, now God's giving his law, he's revealing his will to the people, and you've got strange sights, strange sounds. Now, if you looked at that independently, you might not think too much about it. But you start putting this in parallel with Acts chapter 2, and you start thinking, huh, there was more to that than what met the eye. Acts chapter 2, verses 1 through 3, Dolores.
Okay, when the day of Pentecost came, they were all together in one place, and suddenly a sound like the blowing of a violent wind came from heaven and filled the whole house where they were sitting. They saw what seemed to be tongues of fire that separated and came to rest on each of them.
Okay. Now the phenomenon is not exactly the same, but you do have the same kind of activity in both places. And then let's pick up, since you're right there, Acts chapter 2, verse 2 again. I know you just read that.
Okay. Suddenly a sound like the blowing of a violent wind came from heaven and filled the whole house where they were sitting.
Okay. That was Acts chapter 2. I'm going to get the reference here that we just had. Up there, verse 2. And then, Betty, back to you. Let's take a look at Exodus chapter 19, verse 16.
19:16.
Uh-huh.
appearance on the third day in the morning, that there were thunders and lightning, and a thick cloud on the mount, and the voice of the trumpet exceeding loud.
All right, so here you have a trumpet. And the trumpet is described how? All right, you have this loud trumpet-like noise. Now let's go back to what Dolores said, Acts chapter 2, verse 2. You have this sound that's like a rushing mighty wind. Well, wind, trumpet, two different sounds, but again, if they're loud, you would say, wow, that was loud, and you do have a direct parallel there. You have deity present, Acts chapter 2, verse 4, Exodus chapter 19, verses 18 and 20. And then this one that people are probably most familiar with. Betty, let's move forward a little bit and look at Exodus chapter 32:28. Exodus 32:28, and while you're getting there, Dolores, let's go back to you. Look at Acts chapter 2, verse 41. Acts 2, verse 41. We'll start there.
Yeah, okay. Those who accept.
I was giving you a minute to get there, so we'll come back to you in just a second, but thanks for being so speedy. Acts 2:41.
Okay, those who accepted his message were baptized. And about 3,000 were added to their number that day.
Okay. Now, we made the point about 3 weeks ago that when you look at that verse, how many were saved? About 3,000. And we took a little while in the class to make that point, but I think that's important because when you go back and you find the information in Exodus chapter 32, verse 28, it's an exact parallel. 32:28. All right, so under that Old Testament system, about 3,000 die. Under the New Testament system, when God gives his law on the day of Pentecost, about 3,000 are saved. They received eternal life. Exodus chapter 24, verse 12. And then, Jeff, I'm going to take you outside the book of Acts to the book of Hebrews, if you don't mind. We'll run you over to Hebrews chapter 8. Hebrews 8, verse 10. And then we'll flip you over once more to another New Testament book. That'll be 2 Corinthians, but Hebrews 8, 10. Betty, let's go back to Exodus chapter 24, verse 12. Okay, God said, I'm going to reveal my law. And where am I going to put my law? I'm going to reveal my law on stone. Okay, well, that's understandable. Then let's take a look at what we have in Hebrews chapter 8, verse 10.
For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, saith the Lord. I will put my laws into their mind and write them in their hearts, and I will be to them a God, and they shall be to me a people.
Yeah, so this is quote from the Old Testament, but God said, I'm going to put my law where? Not on a stone, not on a rock, but it's going to be inscribed where? Now it's going to be inscribed on the human heart. And then, Jeff, let's run you over to that last one, 2 Corinthians 3, verse 3. And Betty, we'll ask you to get about where you were, going one chapter back, Exodus 31, verse 18. Exodus 31, 18, 2 Corinthians 3, verse 3. If you're ready, Betty, Exodus 31, verse 18.
31, 18.
Uh-huh. Okay, written how? By God's finger. Okay, well, again, that's not literal, but God doesn't actually have fingers. He's spirit, but that's how the Old Testament law was given. Now, 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 3.
For as much as ye are manifested and declared to be the epistle of Christ ministered by us, written not with ink, but with the Spirit of the living God, not in tables of stone, but in fleshly tables of
Yeah, so another contrast there, written with God's finger. Now it's actually the Spirit of God. So when we look at Exodus chapter 19 up to about chapter 32, what took place there with the Hebrew people, we have the birth of a nation. But when we look forward in Acts chapter 2, we've now got the birth of what? The church. So it's very interesting that when you go back and you look at what God did for his people, several things that if we look at them outside of Acts chapter 2, we'd say, well, he did some important things and that's all interesting. But when you start running the parallels between those places in Exodus and Acts chapter 2, you begin to see that great principle that we've tried to point out oftentimes on Sunday nights, that the whole Bible is a united book. And you do have many items in the Old Testament which were true events, but they were pointing forward to something new, something better, and that would be the New Testament. So even when God gave the old law, he was, in my mind, hinting to the people that this is temporary. This is going to be a system that's going to be in place. But what's happening here is foreshadowing. It's pointing to something far, far greater
That, of course, would be the New Testament that we now live under. Anything that you want to add or ask over what we covered thus far? Okay, well, let's switch from there to some other things. When we think about Acts chapter 2, we read about the day of Pentecost. What was Pentecost? Anybody remember? A Jewish? All right, there was the Jewish feast. How many annual feasts did the Jews have that they were required to attend each year? One, two, or three? I'll narrow it down. It wasn't one, it wasn't two, so it must have been three. Three annual feasts they were required. One was Passover, one was Pentecost, and one was Tabernacles. And if you were to go back to verses like Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 16, God said, all the Jewish males, they're to appear before me three times a year. Passover feast, we'll begin with it. That was also known by some other names. And this is where sometimes things can get a little confusing, because just as we might have, as you look around town, you're going on a particular street. If you don't know that some of our streets go by three or four different names, can it be confusing to somebody who's just moved here? You say, well, that street, well, I don't know that road by that name. And then, well, there's a Pizza Hut, and there's the gas station over here, and then there's, oh, yeah, I know what that is, but I know it by a different name. Well, you have that same kind of thing sometimes in the Bible, and that happens with the feast. When we look at the feast, the Passover feast was also sometimes known as the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Now, when you think about that name, the Passover feast, just the name would take you back to what Bible event? The Passover feast. All right, the Passover. And what happened during the Passover? All right, well, there was some heavenly creature. The Bible doesn't use the word death angel, but you're right. There was some divine force. That was the last plague, that it was time for God to release his people from Hebrew bondage. So there's this force that comes through Egypt. The Hebrews have put the blood on the door frames of the homes, and they're passed over. The Egyptians, they lose their firstborn. That feast was celebrated on the 10th day of Nisan. That would be roughly equivalent to our March or April, so we're well past that time right now. And it's kind of interesting. If you go back and you look, when was the lamb slain? When was the lamb killed? For the Jews that were going to celebrate the Passover feast. What time of day? Remember? Morning, afternoon, evening.
The evening of Passover?
Yes, that's right. It was celebrated in the evening, and that's when this particular feast was held. And then after the feast, do you remember God said there was a seven-day period? There was supposed to be 7 days where the people didn't eat something. Anybody remember what that was?
What?
Type of bread. You're right. After the Passover, you were not supposed to eat unleavened bread for 7 days. Now, if you'll take a look at this, let's go back. If you turn over to Acts this morning, just a couple chapters back, Luke chapter 22, verse 1. You have there, the Bible says, now the feast of the unleavened bread drew nigh. And then it says at the end of the verse, which is called the Passover. Well, that's a helpful verse because it tells us that by Jesus' day, you do have the Passover in the Bible. You do have the 7 days of unleavened bread. But the Bible tells us in Luke 22, verse 1, that by the time Jesus came along, they kind of merged things together. We do that same kind of thing today. A person is involved with something for a long time, and even though there's a distinction between the two, we sort of lump them together and maybe don't make a fine distinction now that we used to in the past. So Passover, unleavened bread, first feast. Then we have a second annual feast, and that would be the one that we read about here in the book of Acts, the second chapter, and this, of course, would be Pentecost. Pentecost would have been involved with the spring wheat harvest, and just like the unleavened bread or the Passover feast, Pentecost was also known by some different names. Sometimes it was called the Feast of Harvest. You can find that back in the book of Exodus, Exodus chapter 23, verse 16. It was also sometimes known as the Feast of Weeks. Well, that should get our attention a little bit. Exodus chapter 34, verse 22. Pentecost, we may not deal with this today, but Pentecost means 50, and this was a feast that was involved with counting. You would count, if you're going to get to 50, how many weeks would you count?
Seven.
And then you add one day to that, and then you are to the 50th day. And you can see that in the Old Testament. Then you have feast number three. This was the Feast of Tabernacles, and we're probably familiar with that too. When we think about Jesus, he tabernacled, he lived among men. When it was time for the Jewish people to have the Feast of Tabernacles, where do you think they lived for a little while? Where was their home? All right, they went out there, they made the booths. And you do have some information about that in the Old Testament. That would have been in the September, in the October time period. Now, when you think about that time period, September, October, especially in this area, what might you find out there in the fields? All right, you think about harvest time. And that was also true for the Jewish people. This was a time of harvest. And that's why some people referred to this as the Feast of Ingathering, and it also lasted 7 days. The people were out there, they made the booze, and you can find that back in Leviticus chapter 23, verses 39 to 43. Josephus was a historian from way back, and he claims that this was the greatest and the holiest feast for the Jewish people. I'll give you a quote here. The rabbi said, "The man who has not seen these festivities does not know what Jubilee is." So that's not the feast that we're dealing with as far as tabernacles in Acts chapter 2, but the Feast of Tabernacles was a big, big deal. Some people have tried to compare it to our Thanksgiving, and that may not be the best comparison, but that's been a recent holiday for us, and if you had a good Thanksgiving, there was a lot to be thankful for, a lot of bountiful food. That might not be a bad way to try to picture this third feast. A couple of the quick points here. The temple, sources have noted, was illuminated by large candlesticks. It reminded the people of the guiding pillar of fire. And each day the priests would carry water from the pool of from a golden vessel, reminding the Jews of the miraculous provision of water from the rock. And this feast, we read about it only one time in the New Testament, and that's back in the book of John, chapter 7, verse 2. Now, let's take that information and attach it to what we have here. If when God gave his law to the Hebrew people, he was also thinking in terms of what was going to come down the pipe. That is, I'm going to use a mountain, and that's going to point forward to the church, Mount Zion. And we're going to have here redeemed people, redeemed out of physical bondage, redeemed from spiritual bondage in Acts chapter 2. As far as the 50 days, that's going to be a parallel. The time that the system is going to be introduced, it's going to be in the morning. The people in the camp, all together, sounds from heaven, all the different parallels. If he went to that much work, that much time, that much trouble, then when we start looking at some other items in the Old Testament, specifically the three feasts that we just talked about, do you suspect if God is consistent that he would have had, as he gave those three feasts to the Jewish people, he would have also had in mind some things with those feasts that pointed forward to the New Testament? What do you suspect? Those feasts likely did point forward somehow to something, and that is exactly right. Thinking about the Passover feast. What again was that feast? We just talked about it. God said, going back to the Egyptian bondage, God's people there, they're slaves. All right, I'm going to pass over the firstborn. Do you think some of those firstborn were still perhaps infants? Not accountable for their sins? Sure. I mean, if you just had a baby yesterday, and that was your first baby, and that 10th plague comes along, you're going to lose your firstborn within 24 hours? Yeah, I mean, you can imagine the grief. And that also applied to the livestock. But how would you take that physical activity? They physically lost their firstborn. And think about that in terms of a spiritual application. Spiritually, how would that relate? Well, okay, I think you would want to give consideration to that. What else? Passing over. Not because of now physical death, but now because of spiritual death, salvation. God says, when it comes to sin, I'm going to have judgment fall upon the world. But if you're one of my people, if you've embraced my son, when it comes time for the judgment to fall on you, what's going to happen? Jesus is our Passover. He's the one whose blood allows sin to be passed over. So probably there was almost nobody, maybe a handful of people, but as far as understanding the real significance of the Passover feast, that just wasn't grasped. But can you imagine, and I think this would have been one of the great things for preachers in the Old Testament era, especially as they went among the Jews, they would have said, okay, and maybe even during that time, Passover feast is here, and you've celebrated this, you know the history of it, but do you know who was the fellow who always told the rest of the story? Yes. And we're fascinated by that. You know, if we listened to him over the years, we always thought that was kind of interesting to hear the rest of the story. Imagine being in a Jewish audience, there's a preacher who's a Christian who stands up and says, today I'm going to tell you the rest of the story. He stands up, he makes those parallels to the Jewish people, and then if we were in that Jewish audience, the question on our mind probably would be, okay, what about some of the other things? What about the cities of refuge? Do they relate to the Christian age? What about the feast? Do they relate to the Christian age and so forth? And then the preacher would have been able to continue and say, great question, yes, and here's how that works. Okay, let's think about the second feast. This, of course, would have been Pentecost. And remember, Pentecost was that ingathering feast. It's time to gather in. It's time to collect the crops. Well, for the Jewish people, that's fine. They're thinking, this is good. We're able to go out and get produce, and we need the food and so forth. But taking that and putting a spiritual application on it. What was the spiritual application? Yeah. And that's what you begin to find as you look at Pentecost. You find down there in about Acts chapter 2, verse 41. Let me flip back over there. We'll look at both of those references. King James can be a little more helpful here as far as illustrating the point. But Acts 2, 41 and then Acts 2, verse 47. They then that received his word were baptized, and there were added unto them. That is, they were gathered in. They were brought into the flock. And then, as you look at that final verse in the chapter, 47, praising God, having favor with all the people, and the Lord added to them, day by day, those that were saved. So yes, Pentecost was a great feast, but at the same time, it also pointed forward to what we're talking about here. Then, if you think back to this point, we talked about Pentecost before. I mentioned to you that when we look at the feast, they were sometimes known by different names. One of those different names, Leviticus chapter 23, verse 17, was first fruits. When we think about first fruits, and we do that even in our culture, what's the first fruit?
First picking of a vegetable or a fruit.
It is. And when you do that, there's an expectation, is there not? I got my first banana. Well, we probably don't have too many banana trees handy, but I got my first pear, I got my first apple, I got my first peach. And what's the thinking? Well, there could be that. But this is the first, but it's not going to be the last. First fruit suggests that more will follow. And when you think about Pentecost, first fruits, were there some first fruits? About 3,000 people. Were there some more on the way? Yes, and that's what you begin to see in the book of Acts. So when we think about Passover, when we think about Pentecost, both very, very significant. And then, okay, that would seem to pretty much sum it all up, wouldn't it? I mean, Christ has passed over. He allows our sins to be passed over. And we have the ingathering. People are continuing to be brought into the fold. So what else is left to discuss? We've got that third feast. And now let's take it and complete the picture. Passover, Pentecost, number two. Third feast. Anybody remember what that was?
Tabernacles.
Very good. And if you're out there in the tabernacle, how long are you going to be out there in your little construction? You know, you got the twigs over you and you got your little shelter there. How long are you going to stay out there? Not long. About a week. And you're headed back home. How could that possibly relate to the Christian era? For a Christian, sins have been dealt with. There's this ingathering. But now we've got this third feast. Tabernacles. You're out here for just a little time, and then you go home. How does that relate to the gospel?
We should be out in the world.
Well, that would be a good answer. Is this world or home? No. It is temporary. We're pilgrims, we're strangers. So when you look at these three feasts, it's almost like a mini summary of the gospel. God says, if you want to be my people, I'll cover you with the blood. Passover. Pentecost, you're welcome. We're going to be gathering you in. And if you become part of the body, this world is not your home. You're going to be here for a temporary time. You're going to be like the folks who were out there in the wilderness. But your home, the promised land, is coming. Just stick with it. So very, very amazing when you go back and you see the parallels between Exodus, Acts, what happened on the day of Pentecost a couple thousand years ago, and you also begin to look at these feasts. So if you've never looked at the Bible that way, there was a lot more going on there than we may just first realize. Any thoughts you have about that or any questions that you would like to ask?
Both are deliverance. Deliverance.
Yes, that's right. And you have that with the Passover, and we continue to live faithful lives, and it all comes out. Successful force in the end. Okay, let's think about some additional reasons to see why God introduced the feast on the day of Pentecost. Of the three Jewish feasts that we just talked about, this second one, Pentecost, that was going to be the day likely on which most people attended. When you look at the Jewish people, they were dispersed throughout the Mediterranean world. That's just like us. Different things might call us back to where we grew up. I mean, if this area is not our home. For example, you get an invitation to high school reunion, and you graduated from Texas. Now, some people might say, well, I'd like to go, I wouldn't mind going, but driving halfway across the country to go to a high school reunion, that's probably not going to happen, or at least it's not going to happen this time, or there's another event. But you know, there's some events in life where when they come up, you think, I might have to fly 1,000 miles, but I'm going to make the trip. What kind of event would be like that? All right, it's going to be a wedding. It may be that you've lost someone, but there are certain events which are just so significant. You say, my normal routine has to be disrupted. I have to put some time, some events aside so I can do that. And this was one of the feasts. God said attend them all, but this was the one where people would have usually come back. And there were some reasons for that, reasons that we still face today. Anybody ever intended to go to an event? Maybe a really important event and you couldn't go for some reason? I think most of us have had that experience. What would stop us?
Health.
All right. Could be a health issue. You think any of the Jews ever got sick? No. Yeah, they were people. They had that problem. What else might stop you, though?
Another event.
All right. There could be something else that comes up. That's true. Anything else?
Transportation doesn't work out.
Yes. That's probably going to be the biggest answer as far as what we want to look at when it comes to this question. If you're a Jew and you're way over here, you're scattered throughout the Mediterranean world, and you're going to try to travel back, sea may not always be conducive to getting back. So just as we have problems, oftentimes it involves an airplane, the Jews also had some travel. Travel by sea was often hazardous, and that was certainly true when it came to some of the feasts. But when you look at Pentecost, that was not so much an issue as far as sea travel. This would have been one of the safer times to travel. So if a Jew had circumstances that were going to interfere with getting back to the feast, this probably was going to be the feast that they could get back to. Then notice this point. It's subtle, but it's in Acts chapter 2, verse 1. And when what? And when the day. When the day. So this isn't something that they've got to come back and have a week off for, but this is a one-day event. This is when the day came. And that was one more reason why when Pentecost came, you probably were going to have a maximum amount of people. Now, in years past, I don't know, I thought about this over the years, but I've seen some estimates in years past which has said that more than 1 million people were in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost. That, to me, still seems a little bit high, but it was a well-attended feast. Then there are some other things that factor into why Acts 2 brings us to the introduction of the church. There are some sources, which, again, these may or may not be correct, but there are some sources which indicate that after Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 AD, when Pentecost was celebrated, it wasn't always celebrated on the right day. Now think about what that would have meant. If the church is introduced on Pentecost and it's the wrong day, could that have set a series of events in motion which would have fouled up Christianity? Absolutely. God had created this elaborate system that we've talked about. And for things to work, as he set it up, it needed to come, and it needed to be celebrated on the right day. And by the time that we come to, in Acts chapter 2, prior to 70 AD, about 40 years prior to that time, things were still going correctly as far as the Jews celebrating this particular day. And that day would have been Sunday. We talked before about the 7 weeks, and then adding a day that you find in the Old Testament, Pentecost would have come on Sunday. And Sunday is an important day. Let me see if there's anything that you want to add or ask before we run some references here. Anything that you'd like to interject? Okay. Yes. What we refer to as the first day of the week now, or Sunday. Yes. And you can show that by the Old Testament. Now, after we get to the destruction of Jerusalem, the Romans came in, messed up the records, destroyed the temple and everything. So I can understand why at least some think that it was not necessarily celebrated on that day, but we're well decades prior to that time here. I ran some of these references in a sermon, and I'd like to give them to you, so if you'd like to jot them down as far as some personal notes, as far as the Lord's Day Sunday, the day that we're dealing with in Acts chapter 2, let's get some helpers lined up. Acts 20, verse 7, we're going to take a look at what the Bible says about this day on which Pentecost came, Sunday, the first day of the week. Acts 20, verse 7, that'll be Lois. Then we'll take a look at Mark 16, verse 9, that'll be Steve. 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2, Brian. And then we'll take a look at 1 Corinthians 11, verse 20. Brian, I'll also ask you to go back there too. 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2, and then 1 Corinthians 11, 20. 1 Corinthians 4, 17, 1 Corinthians 4, verse 17. Dolores, thank you. Then we'll look at two references from the book of John. If you read John 20, 19, we'll also ask you to read John 20, 26, and I'll give you that second reference again later. John 20, verse 19 is where you start. All right, is that Jenny? Okay, Jenny 20, 19, and then Revelation chapter 1, verse 10. Revelation 1, 10 is the last one. Who wants to be your helper? Betty. Let's go back to where we started, Acts chapter 20, verse 7.
And on the first day of the week, when we were gathered together to break bread, Paul began talking to them, intending to depart the next day, and he prolonged his message until midnight.
Thank you. Now, church starts on Sunday, Acts chapter 2, first day of the week. When we start to look at some of the people who became Christians, Acts chapter 20, verse 7, what day do we happen to read about their meeting on? First day of the week, Sunday, Acts chapter 20, verse 7. Now, is that a coincidence? Or is there a reason that we find those two things? Well, let's look a little more deeply into the scriptures. Mark chapter 16, verse 9. Mark 16, verse 9. Okay. That's okay. I may have given it to you incorrectly. So.
Now, when he rose early on the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, out of whom he had cast seven demons.
Okay, now let's look at these in reverse. What happened on the first day of the week? Jesus was raised. Acts 20, verse 7, that Lois read. On the first day of the week, the followers of Christ happened to be meeting and worshiping on what day of the week? First day of the week, Sunday. And as we look over here, Pentecost comes on what day? Sunday. Now, all of that sure seems to be somewhat odd if God was not trying to tell us something. So let's go a little more deeply. 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2. Now, this is a different group of people than we have described in Acts chapter 20 and verse 7. 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2.
Now, concerning the collection for the saints, as I've given orders to the churches of Galatia, so you must do also. On the first day of the week, let each one of you lay something aside, storing up as he may prosper, that there be no collections when I come.
Okay, first day of the week is what Paul discusses with the Corinthians. And it almost sounds like we've got another reference that we'll get to from 1 Corinthians chapter 4, and Brian's going to be turning back to 1 Corinthians 11, 20, too. But it almost sounds like the Corinthians and the Galatians also were instructed about this first day of the week. Let's go back to 1 Corinthians 11, verse 20.
Therefore, when you come together in one place, it is not to eat the Lord's Supper.
Okay. The Corinthians were coming together, 1 Corinthians 11, 20, and they weren't partaking of the Lord's Supper in the right way, but at least they knew that that was the day in which to partake of the supper. And the day that they were coming together on, 1 Corinthians 11, verse 20, was what day, 1 Corinthians 16, 2? It's that same day that we've been looking at, the first day of the week or Sunday. Okay, well, let's back up a few chapters and look at 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 17. Sure, 1 Corinthians 4. That's kind of a curious passage. Paul said, when I go from congregation to congregation, I teach different stuff or the same stuff? I teach the same stuff. Okay. Well, that sort of makes sense because in 1 Corinthians 16, he says, I gave information to you, but I also gave it to who else? The Galatians. And then when Paul is with some people over there in Acts chapter 20, verse 7, what day is he meeting on? That same day they talked to the Corinthians about, the day that they were coming together, 1 Corinthians chapter 4. All of this sure puts a lot of attention on the first day of the week or Sunday. Well, let's now go back and look at an event that happened shortly after Jesus' resurrection. Let's go back to John 20. We'll start with verse 19, and then we'll go back to 26. I think that's you, isn't it, Jenny? John 20, 19. Now, if the Lord had made an appearance or several appearances to the disciples, we might not think that that's unusual. We would expect that. But here, the appearance is not only described, it is it's attached to, it's associated with a specific day. And what's that day? The first day of the week. Why did John include that detail? And then, let's go down to what we find in verse 26 of this chapter.
And after 8 days, his disciples were again inside, and Thomas with them. Jesus came, the doors being shut, and stood
Okay, this would have been the following Sunday. And once again, John not only talks about another appearance by the Lord, but specifies that it was on this same day, on the first day of the week, 8 days later from that preceding Sunday, would have been another Sunday. So from multiple perspectives, from the resurrection to the day in which the church was established to when congregations were coming together, to Paul saying, look, I'm teaching the same thing in every congregation. It's Sunday, 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 first day of the week, first day of the week. And then you have this statement over in Revelation chapter 1, verse 10, which by itself we might not be able to put anything with it. But when we take this passage, in lieu of all the other pieces of information we have, I think it all ties together quite well. Revelation chapter 1, verse 10. When was the Lord's Day? By itself, Revelation 1:10 doesn't tell us. But when we start looking at these other things, John appeared to the disciples two times, two different Sundays, from John chapter 20. Church was established on the first day of the week on Sunday. It sure sounds like the Lord's Day is Sunday, and Sunday is the day when you have what? The Lord's Supper. We know that for sure. In life, it was as we look at our court system, if the prosecutor has one piece of evidence, you may or may not be guilty. But sometimes the prosecutor says to the jury, we have what as far as the evidence? We have the, it's that magical P word, preponderance of the evidence. We have so much evidence from so many different directions that we might not have had an eyewitness. But there is sufficient evidence to prove either this man or these men are guilty or not guilty, and that is exactly right. So when we look at the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2, here's what we have. We have the right men. Jesus had talked about that as far as Mark chapter 9, verse 1. He said, some here that stand by, they're going to see the kingdom of God come within a lifetime. He talked about the apostles and to the apostles in Acts chapter 1, verse 8. He talked about the right place, and that's what we find, Jerusalem, in Acts chapter 2. He talked about the right time, the last days, Joel 2:28 and 29, Acts chapter 2, 16 and 17. He talked about the right power, that is the Holy Spirit. He talked about the right message, repentance and remission of sins, back there in Luke chapter 24. He talked about the right name, that is his name. He talked about the right audience, devout men from every nation under heaven.